Hello and welcome to the Clue-In webinar series Narpen Presents. It's RIPRF for RPMs. My name is Michael Adam, and I'm from the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Information, which also is sponsoring this seminar. And I will moderate today's Q&A sessions and the seminar. Before I introduce our speaker for today's seminar, there are a few housekeeping things, logistics, I need to point out, and that you can find also many of these on slide number 2. If you are using a phone line, please mute your phone, but do not put us on hold. If you do not have a mute button, you can use *6 to mute. We will have a Q&A session where those on the phone can take your phone off mute to comment and ask questions. At that time, you may hit #6 to unmute. Those listening on either streaming audio or on the phone line can type questions in to the moderator by hitting the question mark icon at the top of the HTML presentation. We will be holding Q&A sessions later in the presentation. But you do not need to wait until the Q&A sessions to submit questions via the text form. You may also use this form to alert us of any technical difficulties you may be having. The presenter will alert you which slide you that we are on. You will have to manually advance each slide if you're using the HTML version or the offline PowerPoint presentation. If you're using the HTML, you can use the navigate the presentation with the arrow buttons at the top of the screen, also illustrated for you on slide number 2. You should have already clicked to the Go To Session button at the top of the seminar homepage. After the session, you can access the feedback form and the links from the sidebar buttons on the seminar homepage. We've also provided a link on the last slide of this presentation for these. If you wish to receive a printout receipt of your attendance, you can print the confirmation form that is displayed after you filled out the feedback form. This event is being recorded and will be archived on the Clue-In website. In 1 to 2 weeks, you will be able to download it in several formats or replay it online. You may also subscribe to our Clue-In podcast to receive new archived seminars as they become available. You may subscribe to all our RSS feeds by navigating to the news feed page by going to the Clue-In homepage, clicking on the RSS feeds button on the same connected right-hand sidebar. Again, please make sure to have muted your phone. You may use *6 to mute your phone if it does not have a mute function. Today's instructor presenter is Dave Phillips. Dave is a chemical engineer and regulatory analyst with over 23 years of consulting experience. He has instructed several CEC courses and participated in both OSC Readiness and the NARPM training program. You can read more about his bio at the seminar homepage. Now it's time to turn over the presentation to Dave. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, thanks, Mike. All right, let's go ahead and get started. We got a lot of material. Normally, this course, when we give it at NARPM, it's about a four-hour course, 3.5 hours. So we're trying to condense it into 2 hours. There are four major areas of the presentation. The first thing we'll talk a little bit about is just an introduction to the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, kind of an overview of the law and the regulations implementing provisions of RCRA. Most importantly, we're going to be focusing on hazardous waste identification, hazardous waste management. And then we're going to get into specifically three different areas I'd like to talk about today. The most important thing with respect to RCRA is waste identification, how to determine whether something's a hazardous waste. We're going to spend about 40 minutes on that. The other major area we're going to talk about is the land disposal restrictions regulations or land ban program and how that affects management of hazardous wastes. I'm hearing in the background somebody might be typing or you're on their computer. If you can, mute your phone so we're not picking up your keystrokes. Appreciate that. Thank you. And then the final area we'd like to talk about are just some special rules and regulations that EPA has established with respect to managing hazardous waste remediation wastes. And these were to provide, these special rules and policies, their primary purpose is to provide flexibility with respect to managing hazardous remediation waste that would otherwise be subject to, most importantly, the RCRA land disposal restrictions and what we refer to as the RCRA minimum technology requirements. And we'll talk more about what those are a little at the end of the of this session. I'll try to field questions as we go. It's a little bit difficult in this format to do that, but should you have a burning question or something that you are interested in, you know, please feel free to unmute your phone and pose it to us, and I'll try to answer it as briefly as I can. With that, let's go ahead and get started on Module 1, the RCRA overview, and we'll go to the next slide, which is our why are RCRA requirements important to RPMs? Well, the purpose, why you should be interested in RCRA is it tells you what's going to be considered a hazardous waste or not a hazardous waste. And as such, it establishes many action-specific, applicable or relevant appropriate requirements, ARARs, for on-site waste management. In addition, if it is a hazardous waste and those wastes are sent off-site for subsequent management, there will be numerous requirements that apply to the off-site transportation and the facilities that receive the waste off-site in terms of managing it. And it's real important because as an ARAR, it can affect your strategy as well as your costs with respect to characterizing and managing both on-site and off-site waste that are generated during response actions. So RCRA is one of those ARARs that seems to always come up in the course of a circular response, provided it's a no, you know, not a no further action response. The next slide, just a brief overview of what RCRA is, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. It was enacted back in 1976. It's been around for a while. And it was enacted by Congress to address problems with improper management of solid and hazardous waste. Hazardous waste is a subset of solid waste, and we'll get more into that when we discuss the regulatory definitions of hazardous waste and solid waste in a few minutes. But the idea behind RCRA, or the goals, were to protect human health and environment from improper management of wastes, and as well as to minimize wastes, conserve energy and natural resources, and importantly, to reduce the amount of waste that was generated in the future. So these are some of the overarching goals of the RCRA law. Since RCRA was enacted, there have been several major amendments. I've went to the next slide here, statutory framework of RCRA. And those major amendments are the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments of 1984. These amendments were Congress's response as well as EPA's input to Congress in terms of amending RCRA based on early implementation of RCRA by EPA in the states back in the 1980s. The other major amendments to RCRA since then have been the Federal Facilities Compliance Act of 1992. This just clarified that federal facilities must comply with RCRA requirements, both the federal RCRA requirements, RCRA implemented by the states, and local hazardous waste regulations, just like anybody else. And then in the mid-90s, there was some flexibility provided to the Land Disposal Restrictions Program and some minor amendments that were included there. Now, with respect to the RCRA law, it creates three major regulatory programs. Solid waste, which we refer to Subtitle D because that's the section of the law that authorizes requirements and administration of a program for managing solid waste. Hazardous waste, which is authorized under Subtitle C of RCRA, and then a program that was added in 1984 to address leaking underground storage tanks, which is established under Subtitle I. Our focus for this workshop will be on the requirements dealing authorized under Subtitle C, dealing with hazardous waste. Now to the next slide, the regulatory framework for implementing RCRA. The subtitle C authority provides EPA with comprehensive authority for implementing or issuing regulations on hazardous waste identification, management, and corrective action. The initial regulations established by EPA came out in 1980. There have been numerous requirements that have been issued since that time. Although the program's relatively mature in the last few years, there hasn't been as much activity, obviously, as in times past. The federal regulations are found in Title 40, Code of Federal Regulations, Part 260 through 279. Those are the sections that deal with hazardous waste, universal wastes, and used oil. Used oil is also regulated under RCRA as well. Turning to the next slide, this really, the purpose of this slide is just to let you know that under RCRA, states may be delegated authority to implement the RCRA requirements in lieu of the federal EPA or EPA regional offices. The vast majority of states have RCRA authorization. I think there are only two states, Iowa and possibly Alaska, I think may have turned their program back over to EPA Region 10. But otherwise, all the other states have authority to implement the RCRA regulations. And as a result, you'll be generally referring to the state regulations with respect to identifying ARRs. Most states just incorporate by reference the federal regulations, but other states have adopted additional regulations. For those of you in Region 9 who deal with the state of California, California has a hazardous waste management program, which in many cases is much more broad and stringent than the federal regulations. Most of the other states are pretty much consistent with what the federal government has done. If the state is authorized, as I mentioned, the state's RCRA regulations are the ones that are applicable to the site. Be aware, as if you are in a state like California, you may have environmental laws or regulations that go beyond the federal programs and identify things that would otherwise be non-hazardous under federal RCRA, would be identified as state hazardous waste and need to be managed as such within the state and sometimes other states nearby as well. Okay, now we'll go to Module 2, and we'll talk about hazardous waste determination, or how you go about determining whether something's a hazardous waste, a material is a hazardous waste. The first slide there, hazardous waste determination basics. Again, this is an issue that is almost always addressed during a CERCLA response. Obviously, you'll encounter waste at the site that require some sort of management or active management, I should say. And there's a responsibility for determining whether or not those wastes are hazardous or not, and then complying with the applicable or relevant appropriate requirements regarding the management of those wastes. And so hazardous waste determination is a key. It's a prerequisite for whether RCRA is applicable or not. Now, the basic process to determining whether something's a hazardous waste or not under RCRA is relatively straightforward. There's really four steps in it. And we'll get to what those steps are. But before you evaluate or examine, go through those steps to determine whether something's a hazardous waste or not, you need to know three things about the material in question, or the contaminated soil or contaminated groundwater, contaminated sediments, media that you're dealing with. And those three questions are really important to answer, because that information is going to help you determine it. It's critical to determining whether or not something's going to be a hazardous waste under RCRA. And if you don't answer those three questions, or you don't have answers to them, sometimes you might get a vague answer from somebody in terms of whether something's a hazardous waste or not. So what are the three questions? The first one is, okay, if you're dealing with some material, what is it? that's rather obvious. What am I dealing with? Am I dealing with, you know, a drum of methyl ethyl death? Am I dealing with some sort of contaminated soil? Am I dealing with a waste from a pollution control device like a wastewater treatment sludge? The next question you need to ask is, what produced that waste? That's critical because that information we'll use later to determine whether a waste is listed or not by EPA. Knowing how it was produced is important in that context. And then the other critical thing in terms of RCRA that you need to know about a material when determining whether it's a hazardous waste or not is, what are you going to do with it? And that's really important because the RCRA regulations for hazardous waste determination become really complex if you are considering recycling or otherwise reusing a material. This relates to the definition of solid waste. And if you have a situation where you are going to recycle or reuse a material, the RCRA regulations for defining whether or not that's still going to remain subject to RCRA regulation based is important. On what's important for you to know is you need to know how it's going to be recycled. And it can be pretty complicated there. But the most important thing to come out of this, I think, for you guys, is to be aware of answering these questions first or have some idea of how to answer these questions. What is the material? How is it produced? What are you going to do with it before you go about looking in the regulations to determine whether it's a hazardous waste? I got my start in a program by working on a RCRA Superfund hotline back in the mid-1980s. We answered hundreds of thousands of questions a year, and most of them were about whether something was a hazardous waste or not. And those would always be the three questions we would pose to the callers. Because without some sort of definitive understanding of or answer to those three questions, we could give you two or three different answers. But that's unfortunate, but that's the way RCRA works. The final thing I'm going to say here is that, like all environmental statutes or regulatory programs, RCRA has a whole slew of words that have specific meanings with respect to the regulations and the law. For example, sludge. Sludge is specifically defined under the RCRA regulatory program as a waste from a pollution control device. So when we talk about the definition of solid waste and hazardous waste, we're going to be referring sometimes to terms like commercial chemical product, byproduct, spent material. All these terms have specific meanings. They're defined in the regulations, and so you have to be aware of that. Now we'll move to the next section. As I mentioned, there were like four steps used to identify hazardous waste as established by the regulatory structure. Once you know what it is, what you're doing with it, and how it was produced. And the regulations that are involved in determining whether something's a hazardous waste is, given that information you know about the material, first thing you should do is determine whether it has been excluded from the regulatory definition of solid waste. If it is not, then you determine whether it meets the definition of solid waste. If it does meet the definition of solid waste, then you determine, is that solid waste excluded from the definition of hazardous waste? If it is not excluded, then you determine whether the solid waste meets the regulatory definition of hazardous waste. So those are the four steps. There also is the opportunity for industry or the RPMs or PRPs in this case, under certain unique circumstances, to seek a variance or a petition where something that might be defined as a solid waste or something that might be defined as a hazardous waste by regulation, they can seek a petition to have it not defined as a hazardous waste, something we refer to as delisting. We won't talk much about these variants and rulemaking petitions, but they are out there and they have been used in some unique circumstances and situations in the CERCLA world before. Now let's go to the next slide. This is our first regulatory step in terms of determining whether a material meets the definition of a hazardous waste. you have something, say you have a tank that has some residue in it, and you need to remove that residue as part of your response action, and you're trying to determine whether that residue is a hazardous waste or not. Well, first thing you would, once you know what it is, and let's assume you're going to dispose of it and everything like that, you would check to see if, for some reason, that residue could be excluded from the definition of solid waste. Congress, when they wrote RCRA, excluded certain materials from regulation by defining them, by not defining them as solid waste. And EPA has established regulations in 40 CFR 261.4A. There are several categories of waste streams there where EPA has stated that that particular material is not a solid waste. Therefore, it cannot be regulated under RCRA. I'm not going to go through all of them there, but some of them are things like domestic sewage, materials that are mixed with domestic sewage and they're going to a publicly owned treatment works, point source discharges that are regulated under the Clean Water Act, and that exclusion only applies to the actual discharge, the point of discharge. So if the wastewater stream is being managed upstream of the discharge point, that's still a solid waste under RCRA. But at the point that it passes through the plume or the flume and is monitored, okay, in accordance to its discharge, then what goes into the river or what goes into the sewer system is no longer considered solid waste. So that material is excluded. But there are several ones there that you might come into or be aware of. So if you have a material, first you check to see if it's been excluded by a regulation or it's covered by one of these exclusions. Now let's assume that your material is not covered by one of those exclusions. The next thing you need to do is determine whether your material meets the regulatory definition of solid waste. And this is federally defined in 40 CFR 261.2. And in the regulations, solid waste are defined as, quote, discarded materials. And then EPA has further defined discarded as a material that is abandoned, recycled in certain ways, considered inherently waste-like, or defined as a military munition. The first one I like to talk about is abandoned, because that's pretty much the most straightforward definition. Abandoned simply means you're going to dispose of something, or you're accumulating it with the intent to dispose of it. And dispose means you're going to put it in a landfill, you're going to incinerate it, okay? So that's pretty straightforward. You're going to get rid of something. You have no other use for it. Where the definition of solid waste becomes very confusing is if the material is amenable to recycling or reuse in some way. If that's the situation, then the definition of solid waste can be tricky, because depending on what the material is classified, the agency has established a list of what they call secondary materials. These are things such as sludges, byproducts, commercial chemical products, spent materials. And they have a corresponding list of ways they may be recycled, reclaimed, like in the case of a solvent that's contaminated, but it's going to be redistilled. That's reclamation. It's considered reclamation because you're trying to recover or you know, create a new usable solvent by removing the impurities. Okay, there's a table 1 in 40 CFR 261.2, which identifies the secondary materials that and the method of recycling. And depending on how that material and recycling method fall out and in that table, the material may be defined as a solid waste or not. So that's where most people have trouble with the RCRA regulatory program, is with the definition of solid waste when the material is going to be recycled. It's a complicated thing. I don't have the time to really go into much more discussion on it here. But just bear in mind that that's where you might have some, you know, you have to do a lot more research on it. But it's most important that you, again, know what that material is and how it's going to be recycled. So you can work through the rather complex regulations, regulatory program for determining whether or not it remains a solid waste and subject, potentially subject to RCRA regulation based on how it's going to be recycled. The third element to the definition of solid waste are those materials that are considered inherently waste-like. And these are just a very small subset of very specific waste streams from pesticide manufacturing that the agency identified back in the mid-1980s and said that these waste streams, we don't care how you recycled, we consider these things to be inherently waste-like. It's because they may contain dioxins, and therefore they're always going to be defined as solid waste, no matter, you know, what the subsequent management may be. And then finally, military munitions. This came about in 1997. There was a rulemaking to determine when munitions are considered solid waste under RCRA. There's a separate section in subpart M, part 266, 40 CFR. This comes into play if you're dealing with like closed training ranges associated with Department of Defense installations, or maybe even a formerly used defense site, where you come upon unexplored ordnance or other types of munitions in terms of determining whether they're solid waste under RCRA program. Okay, now we'll move to the next element in terms of determining whether something is a hazardous waste. As I mentioned at the beginning, hazardous wastes are considered a subset of the definition of solid waste. So in order for something to be defined as a hazardous waste under RCRA, it first must meet this definition of solid waste. So we're assuming at this point that whatever material in question we're examining meets the definition of solid waste. So that example I gave earlier, some residue in the tank that you needed to get rid of, well, you're gonna pump it out of the tank, put it into containers, and send it off-site for incineration. Clearly, that meets the definition of being abandoned. As a result, those materials are considered discarded, so they meet the definition of a solid waste under 40 CFR 261.2. Now, the question is, have those materials been excluded from by EPA or Congress from the definition of hazardous waste? And in order to figure that out, we would look in 40 CFR 261.4B. And there's a comprehensive list of materials or solid waste, which Congress in 1980 and 1984, when they amended RCRA, established a number of exclusions for various solid waste from the RCRA regulatory program pending an EPA regulatory determination whether those solid wastes warranted regulation. And some examples of these things are things like coal ash from power plants, mineral processing wastes, a number of other large categories of waste streams, which the agency has studied and evaluated, has made a determination, you know, which mineral processing wastes are considered solid wastes and are covered by the exclusion, or which solid wastes are not covered by the exclusion and therefore could be defined as a hazardous waste because EPA has subsequently listed those, or they exhibit, you know, potentially exhibit any of the characteristics of hazardous waste. But I think there's over 14 or 15 different categories of solid waste which have some form of exclusion from the definition of hazardous waste. It's important to understand that the scopes of these individual exclusions can be very complicated. Some of you may have heard of the Bevel Amendment, which deals with, you know, waste from the processing, beneficiation of ores. And you can have a full-day course just trying to explain the ins and outs of the Bevel Amendment and what waste streams are in and what waste streams are out. Important thing here is that If you do examine 261.4B to determine whether or not you have a waste stream, which is covered by one of its exclusions, what you may read in that CFR, that one paragraph that, you know, discusses the nature and scope of that exclusion, has, you know, 30 pages of preamble language in a Federal Register or a whole book of regulatory interpretive memos, which can be consulted to really clarify the scope of that exclusion. So that it's kind of like when you look at the CFR, sometimes it's the tip of the iceberg. You don't see everything that's underneath there, all the policy or all the interpretation and other documents supporting, you know, the detailed discussion of what that scope of that exclusion is. So just be aware of that if you are dealing with a waste stream that's potentially excluded from the definition of hazardous waste. Move to the next slide, which is finally we get to the definition of hazardous waste. So let's assume that our residue in that tank is not covered by any of those exclusions. How do I determine if it's a hazardous waste now? Well, the first thing is I determine whether I look to see if EP has listed that hazardous waste or listed that particular residue in that tank as a hazardous waste. Congress gave EPA two mechanisms by which they could identify hazardous waste via rulemakings. One was this process where EPA would go out and do a study of a waste stream and make a determination based on the inherent toxicity of it or other attributes of the waste and how it's managed and whether its management posed a risk to human health and environment, particularly if it was improperly managed. If they go through this process, they had the opportunity to actually, through a rulemaking, list that waste stream as a hazardous waste. And EPA has listed numerous waste streams as hazardous waste. These are the ones that are found in 40 CFR 261.31. And they're denoted by, well, we'll talk about that in the next slide, but there's a number of them that are covered by that. But the important thing is if EPA has listed a hazardous waste, all you need to know about that waste stream is how it was produced. Then you go back and you look at the description on the listing, and that's how you can find out whether it's a listed waste or not, simply by knowing how the waste stream was produced. The other primary mechanism that EPA uses to determine whether something's a hazardous waste is by defining a characteristic or a property of a waste stream which makes it hazardous. And the agency has identified four characteristics, and these are the ever popular corrosivity, ignitability, reactivity, and toxicity characteristics. Actually, they also had proposed way back in the early 1980s an infectious characteristic and a radioactive characteristic, but those were never finalized. But there are four characteristics of hazardous waste. The relationship between listed waste and hazardous waste is this. If you have your solid waste, the first thing you need to do is determine whether it meets one of the listings. Has EPA listed it as hazardous waste? If they have not, then you determine whether or not that solid waste exhibits any of the four characteristics of hazardous waste. And if it would, then it would be considered a hazardous waste. There are also two other elements to the definition of hazardous waste, and this deals with the mixtures and derived from waste that are derived from other waste. We'll talk a little bit about the mixture rule and derived from rule in just a few minutes. Let's move to the next slide, which discusses listed hazardous waste. As I mentioned, there are three primary categories of listed hazardous waste: waste from nonspecific sources, and these are in 40 CFR 261.31. And those are identified in RCRA parlance by a prefix with the F, letter F, or F waste is what we call it in the RCRA world, F codes. So F001, F005, F032. These are hazardous waste from non-specific sources. For example, F001 is chlorinated solvents used in degreasing operations. The point here is when we say it's from a non-specific source, is that chlorinated solvent can be used by an auto body shop or by a chemical manufacturer. Didn't matter. If it just meets that description, okay, somebody had used TCE, okay, to clean a part or degrease a part, and they had spent TCE, and that's what you were managing. That was what was inside that tank. That was a residue that was inside that tank. You go to discuss. That's all you need to know. It's a listed hazardous waste. The next category of listed hazardous wastes are waste from specific sources, and those are 40 CFR 261.32, and those are identified by the K code. Now, these are very specific industrial processes that produce these waste streams. And the agency has identified a number of different, they've organized the K code waste into different categories, subcategories based on the industry that produces them. For example, wood treaters, organic chemicals, iron and steel, oil refineries, but there are waste streams associated with specific manufacturing operations. So you have to have, obviously, some fairly detailed information about that waste stream in that industry in order for it to meet the K code or the K listing, as we would say. And the third and final category of listed hazardous waste are a number of commercial chemical products that are identified in 40 CFR 261.33. The idea here simply is that if you came across an unused commercial chemical product like a drum of toluene, okay, that somebody was storing, and you couldn't do anything with it, you were going to throw it away, okay, then if it's on that list, either the U or P code, okay, and it's considered, a technical grade of that toluene, then you would have to dispose of it as a hazardous waste. The other kind of interesting thing where the commercial chemical product listings can come into play is there's also a provision in 261.33 says that, say I had a tank of pure TCE, which I was using to degrease parts as part of my plating process. And this tank leaked, and that TCE got into the soil underneath the tank. I went to clean up that soil. Because I know the TCE came from that tank. There's a provision in 261.33 that says that soil contaminated with TCE is considered a listed hazardous waste, and it's given that U code, or U number that's associated with TCE. So that's one of the unique provisions with that discarded commercial chemical products. Is you're either talking about throwing away essentially a virgin material, or you're throwing away some contaminated debris or contaminated soil as a result of a spill or a release or cleaning up the release from a tank or vessel or container that had previously held the virgin chemical that's identified there. The final thing is the difference between the P and U listings is simply this, is the P denotes those commercial chemical products that are identified as acutely hazardous waste. Acutely hazardous waste is relevant in that if you are somebody who produces a hazardous waste, which we call in RCRA a generator, defined as a generator under RCRA, if you only need to produce 1 kilogram of an acute hazardous waste for it to be subject to full regulation when you go to dispose of it. Whereas if something's a non-acute hazardous waste, you need to produce at least 100 kilograms per calendar month of that substance, or that waste, I should say, that hazardous waste, to be subject to some level of RCRA regulation. If you produce 1,000 kilograms per calendar month of a hazardous waste, you're subject to full RCRA regulations for that waste. So just the thing with acutely hazardous waste versus non-acute hazardous waste, it comes into play in terms of regulating that particular waste at a lower level, smaller amount. A Okay, let's go to the next slide, which talks a little bit more about listed hazardous wastes. And this is kind of more relevant for circular responses and cleanup programs. As I mentioned, listed hazardous wastes, EPA has done the work for you. They've went out and studied a waste stream. They've went through a regulatory process where they proposed a rule and issued a final rule and listed that waste stream as hazardous waste. So if you know what produced it and what the material is, you have the information available to determine whether it meets, you know, the description in the listing and it's a hazardous waste or not. You don't have to do any sort of testing to determine whether something's a listed waste. Obviously, if it's not a listed waste and it exhibits a, and you're trying to determine whether it exhibits a characteristic or property of hazardous waste that EPA has defined, EPA has provided test methods which one can use to determine that. And we're going to talk about those in just a few seconds. But the testing is associated with determining whether something exhibits a characteristic. Listed hazardous waste, it's kind of an administrative endeavor. You simply need to know what the material is and how it was produced, or the what the waste is and how it was produced in order to determine whether it was listed. Now, in Superfund responses, you come to sites a lot of times and you'll have waste streams there and you have no information as to what produced it. And if obviously, if you don't know that, for example, you're cleaning up, removing drums from a landfill or a trench where the drums have been buried sometime way back in the 1960s, and you have no documentation as to what was in the drums or how they got there, it's going to be very difficult for you to determine whether they're listed or not. And what the agency has basically said in as guidance, and they wrote this in a preamble to when they were amending the National Contingency Plan back in 1990, they basically said, if you don't know what it is, and I'm paraphrasing this, but you can go back to the 1990s, I mean, you don't have to assume it's listed, okay? If you don't know definitively what the source was or how, what produced it, you don't have to assume it's listed. You can simply just determine if it's hazardous by virtue of exhibiting the characteristics. So that's something that's important consideration at a Superfund response site. Basis for listing waste. This is something that comes into play when we talk about the mixture and derived from rule. As I talked about earlier, when I said EPA goes through this process of listing a waste, they evaluate a waste stream's toxicity or whether a waste stream inherently exhibits one of those characteristics of hazardous waste. And when they, in those tables of, or descriptions of hazardous waste, you see in 261.3132, like the F&K codes, you'll note that they have a hazard code in that table there, and it will say whether the basis for listing was because of the presence of a chemical that's considered toxic, or in some cases they may have listed a waste simply because they know it's always going to exhibit a characteristic, so it's always ignitable, or it's always reactive only. That's relevant when we go to talk about the mixture and derived from rules, which we'll talk about later. So for those waste streams where the basis of the listing was because one of the chemicals was considered toxic, that's going to be relevant if it's mixed with another hazardous or non-hazardous stream in terms of applying the mixture rule, which would define whether the combination of a non-hazardous and hazardous waste still keeps it, you know, still requires its management of a, as a hazardous waste. Again, it's one of these kind of more involved, you know, regulatory requirements in RCRA, but it is important. And when we go to apply the mixture and derived from rule, especially if we're dealing with listed wastes, if we understand the basis for the listing, that has an effect on the application of mixture and derived from rule. The final thing was acutely hazardous waste, and we talked about that earlier, what its relevance was. Okay, next slide is just a discussion of the four characteristics of hazardous waste. As I mentioned before, there are four of them. Ignitability, and that's the requirements or the definition of ignitability is in 40 CFR 261.21. There are several different means or methods or properties by which one can determine whether something exhibits ignitability. If it's a liquid waste, one of the things you do is you can measure the flash point, which is the vapor, the temperature at which the vapor that exists over the liquid will ignite. And there's a testing method called Penske-Martin's closed cup tester, where you determine the temperature at which that vapor will ignite over that liquid, and if it's less than 120 degrees, it's considered ignitable. There are other methods, ways for determining whether something exhibits a characteristic ignitability as well, but that's one of the more common ones. The second one is corrosivity, and corrosivity, the primary mechanism that's used to determine corrosivity is the pH. There is a test method in the physical chemical methods for solid waste for determining the pH of waste streams. And if you have a pH equal to or below 2 or equal to or above 12.5, so it's at kind of the extreme ends of the pH spectrum, then that waste would be considered characteristic of the corrosivity. Now, one unique thing about the federal definition of corrosivity, or EPA's definition, is it states that the waste has to be a liquid. Sometimes you'll have a waste stream like sodium hydroxide pellets, solid pellets. Federally, if they're not mixed with some water or in contact, and therefore you can take a pH reading of it, they wouldn't meet the definition of corrosivity. Now, some states are more stringent and have regulations that address that, but it's just kind of one of the unique things about RCRA is that when you read the definition of corrosivity, it will refer to a liquid waste. And the way we determine whether some waste has a liquid under RCRA is through the use of something called the paint filter liquids test. And that's the means by determining whether a waste has liquids or not, free liquids. The third characteristic is reactivity, and this is in 40 CFR 261.23. This is probably the most subjective of all the characteristics in that there's really no test method that's used to determine whether something is reactive or not. There's just a description. The idea would be is that the generator, if they were managing something that was reactive, they should have knowledge just based on how they handle it and manage it, that it's potentially reactive. For example, the definition of reactivity tries to identify things that would form, be explosive if they come into contact with air or water. Certain types of like catalysts used in the petroleum refining industry, if they come into contact with air, they can explode or they can spontaneously combust. So those are some examples. Obviously, munitions, because they can go boom, they can are often considered reactive wastes as well. The fourth characteristic is toxicity. And this is the test method used to determine toxicity under RCRA is something called the Toxicity Characteristic Leaching Procedure, or TCLP test. And there are about 30 different chemicals, like 8 heavy metals and a number of pesticides and other organics, constituents, which are evaluated, which are considered toxic and are evaluated by the TCLP. And the idea with a toxicity characteristic leaching procedure test was to identify those waste streams that would leach out these toxic chemicals at levels that would pose a threat to drink to water wells or groundwater if they were disposed of in a landfill. And so that's what the TCLP does. It tries to distinguish those waste that would be considered hazardous because they contain chemicals or hazardous constituents that would leach in significant levels to impair groundwater that was being used for drinking water, and therefore require such waste streams to be managed in a hazardous waste landfill versus a solid waste or subtitle D landfill. Again, with the characteristics, you have a test or you have a description in case of reactivity, which is used to help you evaluate whether a waste exhibits that characteristic. If you produce a waste stream, you can use the test method or you can use your knowledge based on the nature of the waste in determining whether it's going to exhibit any of those characteristics. Okay, we'll get to the next slide here. This is just the next two slides are a brief discussion on the mixture and derived from rules. But again, the definition of hazardous waste is really twofold. If you have a solid waste that hasn't been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste, it's going to be considered hazardous waste if it's listed, if it's not listed, if it exhibits any of those four characteristics of a hazardous waste. The mixture and derived from rules were put into play by EPA to deal with mixtures of hazardous and non-hazardous waste streams. And the bottom line is, or the rule of thumb is, if you mix a listed hazardous waste with something that's non-hazardous, it's going to be considered hazardous waste and required managed, to be managed as a hazardous waste. The derived from rule works like this. If you have a waste and you treat, store, dispose of it, and you create a waste from that waste that you treated, stored, or disposed, then that waste that you created is assumed to be also a hazardous waste as well, if it was derived from the treatment, storage, or disposal of something else that was a hazardous waste beforehand. That's kind of the concept. Now, where it's different is that's what applies typically if you have a listed waste. So if you had a listed hazardous waste, let's go back to the tank residue that we said was TCE, spent TCE, so it's a listed hazardous waste. Let's say I combine that tank residue with some non-hazardous waste, okay, when I went to go, then because that TCE is considered a toxic constituent, and the basis of listing is because that stuff is considered toxic, part of the basis, when I mixed it with something that's non-hazardous, then everything, the resulting mixture becomes hazardous. It has to be managed as such. It would be the same thing if I were deriving a new waste from it. For example, say I took that TCE residue and I ran it through a redistillation still and I created some still bottoms from that. The still bottoms would be considered a listed hazardous waste as well. It's actually covered by the scope of the listing as well. So that's how that works with listed waste. Now, characteristic waste, if I had an ignitable waste and I mixed it with a non-hazardous waste and the resulting mixture was no longer considered ignitable, then the resulting mixture would not have to be managed as a salt, as a hazardous waste. It could be managed simply as a solid waste. So the mixture rule and derived from rule works a little bit differently for characteristic waste. So if I had a characteristic ignitable waste and I treated it, and I generated a waste as a result that was didn't exhibit any of the characteristics, then that resulting waste would not be considered hazardous and could be managed as simply as a solid waste. The final thing is element to the definition of hazardous waste is actually not in the regulations, but it's a policy. And I'll assume some of you or most of you have heard of something called the contained in policy. This came about 1986 because the agency and the Superfund and RCRA corrective action programs began dealing more and more with a lot of contaminated soil, contaminated groundwater, contaminated sediments. And there was always the question we have soil that's been contaminated via a release, or we have sediments that's been contaminated via a release, and we're excavating it, and we're going to send it off-site for disposal. Is that soil or is that sediments that's contaminated considered a hazardous waste? And the agency came out with the contained-in policy, And the short story is if there's a determination made that the soil was contaminated with listed hazardous waste, or if the soil exhibits any of the characteristics of a hazardous waste, then it has to be managed as a hazardous waste. This is an applicable, relevant, appropriate requirement at a CERCLA response. So it's a means of identifying contaminated media as hazardous waste and subjecting it to management under the RCRA Hazardous Waste Management Program. Now, you'll see in the slide where we talk about the determinations made on a case-by-case basis and that lacks definitive federal guidance. Many states have developed specific means for determining whether something contains a listed hazardous waste or not. So a number of states have detailed regulations or policy and guidance on how you determine whether contaminated media contains a listed waste or otherwise has to be managed as a hazardous waste. So there is guidance that's out there, or even regulations, but it's at the state level. So just be aware of this. Again, to summarize the containing policy, it's a mechanism by which you determine whether contaminated media needs to be managed as RCRA hazardous waste on-site or off-site, and so you have to be aware of that. I mentioned the next slide deals with variances and petitions. You have the ability, if you're dealing with a waste that is considered listed by EPA, to petition the RCRA program or the state. I think this has been delegated down to the states. I'd have to double check. It's certainly been delegated to the regional offices, but you can petition them to seek what they call a delisting, and it's just to provide information which allows them to determine that based on the concentrations of the chemicals in the waste, what the waste is, how it's going to be managed, that although it meets the description of the listed waste, it really doesn't sufficiently warrant regulation as a listed waste, and you can obtain a delisting. This occurs sometimes when you're dealing with a huge or a large volume of waste that would be otherwise extraordinarily expensive to manage. And so the appeal there is that you may want to seek a delisting there simply because then you could manage it as a solid waste and reduce your costs with respect to managing it. Similarly, within the states or even in the regions, there's something called a containout determination. Again, this goes back to this contained in policy we talked about just a few seconds ago. If there's a determination made that contaminated media contains a listed hazardous waste, there's procedures, and that's what I'm saying, the states have provided a lot of details on this and guidance and policy at the state level or even in their regulations for how you go about determining to them that the contaminated media has chemicals at levels that are low enough that the state will basically say, will agree that it no longer contains a hazardous waste, a listed hazardous waste, and that allows you to manage the contaminated media as solid waste or special waste within the state's programs, but not as regulated hazardous waste. Finally, there are alternative regulatory programs for certain types of hazardous waste. This is called the universal waste, and the regulations are found in 40 CFR Part 273. Again, and EPA has identified four universal waste batteries, such as nickel-cad batteries, pesticides that have been recalled, mercury-containing equipment like in thermostats or gauges, and then various different types of lamps, fluorescent lamps. Some states have additional universal waste that they identify, such as aerosol cans, computers, circuit boards, things of those nature. So some states have some additional things that they identify in their program as universal wastes as well. But simply put, these are waste streams that, if you encounter these, instead of having to manage them under the regular regulatory program structure for hazardous waste, these wastes may be managed under the universal waste alternative regulatory regime, which provides greater flexibility and less stringent requirements regarding their management. That's really it in a nutshell. So if you encounter these things and you have large volumes of for example, mercury-containing equipment at a cleanup, for example, you're cleaning up and you're demolishing an industrial building that has numerous old thermostats or other mercury type of gauges, containing gauges or other equipment in there, you may avail yourself to using the Universal Waste Management Program as a more flexible means of disposing those materials and managing them. Cadets, all I have on the definition of solid and hazardous waste or hazardous waste determination. A few minutes here. I don't know if anybody has a question out there or would like to ask one at this point before we move to the land disposal restrictions requirements.
I have a question.
Sure. Fire away.
If I understood you correctly, listed wastes are basically wastes that have been determined to inherently have one of the four characteristics.
That's one way, okay, they can do it. The EPA can list a waste because it inherently exhibits one of the characteristics, but that's not the only way a waste can be listed.
Okay, so in that case, you've answered my question, because I was wondering if there was an inconsistency in treating characteristic waste less stringently under the mixture and derive from rules if a listed waste was only listed as one of the characteristics inherently.
Well, yeah, and to kind of answer your question, you're right. The agency does treat, when they apply the mixture rule and derived from rule, they do treat listed waste where the waste was listed only on the basis of it exhibiting the characteristic. They do treat that differently than where the waste was listed based on the presence of a toxic, the chemical or hazardous constituent being defined as toxic.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so you're correct in the way it is, but hopefully I made that clear to you. It's a little difficult over the phone. I feel like sometimes you're talking into the netherworld here. I'm used to drawing something on a board to explain it a little bit better, to illustrate it, but...
Oh, I'm in the netherworld most of the time. That's okay.
as long as your head's not hitting your desk from listening to the discussion of RCRA regulations, you're doing fine. Anyway,
hey, I'm doing this voluntarily.
Wow, good for you. The agency, when they do list a waste, they can list it because it has a presence of a toxic hazardous constituent. I use TCE as an example. TCE is defined as being toxic, and that does have a different ramification than whether they listed something like xylene as a hazardous waste, because xylene is not considered toxic, but it's considered ignitable. And so you'll see, if you look at the list of the hazardous waste solvents that are listed by EPA as hazardous waste, FOO1, FOO2, FOO3, FOO4, FOO5, you'll see that F003 defines spent solvents such as xylene, acetone, and the basis for those being considered listed hazardous waste because acetone and xylenes exhibit the characteristic of ignitability. But they are not considered toxic like FOO1's constituents, which would be TCE, methylene chloride, things like that. And so when we go to apply a mixture rule for those two different waste streams, there are differences that would occur in terms of how that's, the mixture rule would apply to them. Okay, moving on now, we'll talk about the land disposal restriction regulations and how they apply and work. The first thing is a little background on the purpose of the land disposal restrictions. These rules, this whole program came about in the Hazardous Solid Waste Amendments to RCRA in 1984. And at that time, Congress, you know, was very concerned about land disposal of hazardous waste. That was considered the most risky management method for hazardous wastes. And Congress was predisposed to limit or otherwise try to reduce the risk of land disposal of hazardous waste by establishing this land disposal restrictions program. And the idea behind it essentially was, in order to reduce the risk of landfilling hazardous waste, Congress set forth that hazardous waste had to meet a treatment standard. They would be prohibited from being land disposed as they were unless they met a treatment standard. And this treatment standard was defined as some sort of method by which you could reduce the volume, toxicity, or mobility of toxic chemicals in the waste such that it would pose less risk when that treated waste was put into the landfill. So think of it kind of similar to like a pretreatment program under the Clean Water Act. You couldn't simply just discharge the chemicals into the receiving water body. You had to treat it, okay, to reduce the level of pollutants in it before it went into the water body. Same thing with the land disposal program. You know, basically, as a result of the LDR program, as we call it, you could no longer have waste, hazardous waste that was produced, and simply send it directly into a landfill untreated. The regulations establish treatment standards, and so if you generate or produce a hazardous waste, it's going to be prohibited from being placed in what we define as land disposal unless it meets these treatment standards that EPA has established for the waste. So that's the concept with the Land Disposal Restrictions Program. One of the key things that's really important for you to know is it only applies to those wastes that are defined as hazardous waste. So if you have something that's not a hazardous waste, it's a solid waste that's been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste, for example, the LDRs do not apply to it. The federal land disposal restrictions do not apply to it. So the LDRs only apply to something that you've defined as hazardous waste. And that's really important to understand. A lot of people still make that mistake that, oh, we have a waste that's subject to the land disposal restrictions program, until you point out to them that the waste is not considered hazardous, and so the LDRs aren't applicable. That's I want to make that point really clear. The third, land disposal for purposes of land disposal restrictions is broad. It's just not simply landfilling something, too. Congress defined land disposal for purposes of these prohibitions or restrictions as basically placing any hazardous waste on land. So if you're going to put something into a surface impoundment, like a wastewater stream, a hazardous wastewater stream, you're going to place a hazardous waste into a pile or a stockpile. Okay, you were going to inject it into the groundwater, underground injection. Heck, if you were going to put a hazardous waste into a missile silo, you know, an abandoned missile silo, as a means of disposing it, and that was considered and was actually done in some cases. Okay, that was considered land disposal by Congress. And so the waste that were going into those units would be subject to these LDR restrictions. So land disposal is broad, and that has ramifications at Superfund sites for you guys, because you'll be wanting, you know, you'll have, say, some contaminated impoundments or an old landfill's trench, and you want to manage that contaminated media or some of those drums, which are considered hazardous wastes. You simply can't excavate them and put them on a clean soil at that site because you would trigger the land disposal restrictions requirements. That would be placement. Right? And when we talk at the end real briefly about these special rules and policies like areas of contamination, corrective action management units, staging piles, these were all either policies or regulatory requirements the agency came up to provide you with some more flexibility where your management of this contaminated media or hazardous waste at a site wouldn't trigger compliance with these LDR treatment standards. The other thing I'd like to bring up here is this concept of LDRs attached to hazardous waste at the point of generation. Once you produce a hazardous waste or you actively generate it, you have to make a determination whether it is prohibited from land disposal because it does not meet the treatment standards or not. And this carries through. The concept here is simply this. Okay, let's go back to our original example where we were cleaning out those residues from a tank. We said it was like TCE. It was a listed hazardous waste. I cleaned that out. I'm going to send that off-site to a treatment, storage, and disposal facility. Before they can ever put that TCE or waste contained in that TCE into a landfill, they're going to have to ensure that whatever applicable treatment standard applies to that waste is met before that. Before the residual, the treatment residual, can go into a landfill. And basically what that's going to entail is that they're going to have to most likely incinerate it or use some other combustion technology, because I'll explain more how the treatment standards were derived and established in just a second. And then once they incinerate it, the ash will no longer have TCE at levels that prohibit that TCE, the residual TCE in that ash from being landfilled. So that how it comes into play. And its effect on you guys is or the PRPs who are cleaning up their sites, is it's going to escalate their cost for hazardous waste management. So wastes that do not meet the treatment standard, hazardous waste do not meet the treatment standard, will eventually have to be treated before whatever residual that comes out of it goes into a land disposal unit, and that's going to escalate your costs. Or if you develop on-site treatment and you have to treat to meet those LDR standards. The other thing is you may, in the course of treating a waste, render it non-hazardous, but you still have to ensure that LDR treatment standard is met before it can go into a solid waste landfill. So even if in the course of treating a hazardous waste, let's say you have an ignitable waste, you render it non-ignitable, okay? And as we'll discuss, the treatment standard for ignitable waste also says you have to deal with something called underlying hazardous constituents. You would still have to treat for those underlying hazardous constituents, if the regulations require you to do, before that treatment residual could ultimately go into a landfill. So these are just some of the unique provisions and the scope of the LDR program that you should be aware of. And if waste were, for example, disposed of, at any point that you generate a new waste as part of your response action, you'll have to determine if it's hazardous, but you're also going to have to determine whether or not it's subject to this land ban program. Now, the next slide, land disposal restrictions, is where the major regulations, where do we find them that we'll have to address? Federally, they're established in 40 CFR Part 268. And what those regulations are, they're broadly defined as they tell you what waste are prohibited or restricted from land disposal. And the short answer is virtually all hazardous waste are subject to the LDR program now. The other major regulations in 40 CFR 268 tell you what the treatment standards are, and we're going to explain what treatment standards are in just a minute. The other major regulations prohibit you from diluting, okay, a hazardous waste stream as a means of meeting a treatment standard. So dilution is not always the solution in this case, because if you're simply diluting a waste, hazardous waste, to meet a concentration-based treatment standard, that's, okay, that's considered circumventing the intent of the law and the regulations, and that's prohibited. In addition, from an industrial, active industrial standpoint, Congress put about a storage prohibition simply because they want people stockpiling a bunch of prohibited waste as a means of avoiding complying with the treatment standards. So you're not allowed to store hazardous waste for the regulations establish a one-year period as a means of again, not complying with the LDR treatment standards. The other things that you'll have to be concerned, though, with is some of the tracking requirements, and we'll talk about that a little bit later when you send waste off-site. In addition to a manifest for hazardous waste, you'll also have to send a notice to the subsequent handler, at least on the first time the waste goes out to the TSDF, discussing its LDR status, whether it meets treatment standards or whether it doesn't and requires treatment before it can be ultimately landfilled. And then the final set of regulations dealing with the land ban are, again, variances and basically petitions and that allow somebody to obtain an alternative LDR treatment standard for their waste or no LDR treatment, required treatment under certain circumstances. And we'll just discuss this real quickly, probably in about 10 minutes here, and where they've applied at a Superfund site before. Okay, the next slide mentions identification of restricted waste. This is found in 40 CFR Part 268, Subpart C. And simply put, any hazardous waste that's produced today, okay, is going to be subject to the LDR program. And we call those restricted wastes. Now, restricted wastes are prohibited from being placed in the land disposal unit if they do not meet the treatment standards. So if you have a restricted waste that does not meet applicable LDR treatment standards, then it's called a prohibited waste because it's prohibited from being in the landfill. Obviously, if your restricted waste meets the LDR treatment standard, it's no longer prohibited. We just call it restricted waste, but you just call it an old hazardous waste, and it can go into the land disposal unit as is. Again, there was a time where EPA, when they were phasing in this program, could delay the application of an LDR treatment standard or a prohibition for up to 2 years for a particular waste based on no available treatment capacity for that particular waste stream. At this present time, all those variants or those delays that EPA may have established back in the mid-80s or 90s have since passed. So all waste, for all intents and purposes, all hazardous waste that's actively produced or managed now is going to be restricted and subject to LDR treatment standards. The next slide discusses what the definition of a treatment standard is. And just as you're responsible when you're implementing a circular response because you're producing a waste and you're responsible for determining whether it's hazardous, you're also responsible for determining whether if it is hazardous, whether it's prohibited from land disposal and therefore requires treatment before the waste can be land disposed. As I mentioned earlier when I was introducing this section, Congress defined treatment standards in their lawyerly way as any method that reduces the volume, toxicity, or mobility of toxic constituents in the waste. And then they have this one paragraph that they define in statute what they mean by a treatment standard. EPA took that and basically developed treatment standards based on the performance of best demonstrated available technology. So the treatment standards are based on the performance of technology. They're not risk-based standards. So the agency would go out and evaluate technologies such as incineration, steam stripping, biological treatment, what have you, and they would establish treatment standards based on the relevance or applicability of that treatment standard to the waste in question, hazardous waste they were, they're examining. Treatment standards based on performance of technology are expressed in three different manners. They're either identified as a constituent concentration in the treated residual. Okay, so it would be the level of TCE that would be present in the waste after treatment. The constituent concentration in the waste extract, this is simply where they would use the TCLP test to generate basically a leachate, and it would measure the TCE level in the leachate, okay, to determine compliance with the treatment standard. Or the agency would establish a treatment standard based on using a specific technology. So they would say something like, you have to combust. This waste has to be treated via combustion technology. And they would define combustion technology as an incinerator or burning it in a boiler, industrial furnace, cement kiln, something like that. But they have a number of different technologies or methods that they've established, and these can be specified as the required treatment method for the particular waste. Now, when we go about trying to identify what is the treatment standard for a particular hazardous waste, we need to first know, okay, what's the hazardous waste code that's been assigned to? Is it FO2 or is it D008 or D001? So we need to know what type of hazardous waste it is. Then we look at a table in 40 CFR Part 268. It's in 268.40 in the regulations. And you'll see that the treatment standards are generally divided into two treatability groups for a particular hazardous waste. So if we were talking about, say, an ignitable hazardous waste, D001, okay, you would look in the table and you would see that there are two treatability groups. One's called non-wastewater, one's wastewater. Wastewaters are defined as anything that has more than 99% water in it. Non-wastewaters are the opposite. Anything that has greater than 1%, you know, total organic carbon, but less than 99% water. And that makes sense because basically the technologies that apply, you know, that would apply to non-wastewater are going to be like your combustion-based technologies, whereas the things that are defined as wastewater to technologies that EPA used to establish treatment standards are going to be things like steam stripping, biological treatment, conventional types of wastewater treatment technologies that are used to remove pollutants or reduce their toxicity mobility. So when you're trying to establish a treatment, identify the treatment standard for a particular waste, you need to know its waste code, and you need to know whether it meets this definition of treatment of wastewater or non-wastewater, so you know which treatability group to locate it in. Now, within some of these treatability groups, mostly the non-wastewater ones, the agency has subdivided those into subcategories. So you may have a hazardous waste stream that, depending on, you know, that exhibits a characteristic of toxicity for mercury, which I think is D008. You go there and you look in the non-wastewater treatment standards for D008, and you're going to see all these different subcategories, and it's going to be based on the amount of mercury, the total mercury that's in the waste. And depending on which subcategory you fall into, you may have a different treatment standard, either a different specified method or a different concentration number that you need to achieve, again, before that waste could ultimately be placed in the landfill. So that's just in understanding what the treatment standards are, bear in mind that it's first divided into treatability groups and then within those treatability groups, you may have a treatment subcategory. Now, for those of you who aren't as familiar with RCRA, you'll know that there's those waste codes we talked about earlier, the FKU, PU, D code waste for the ignitability characteristic. They can have the same constituent, you know, such as benzene, can be identified as a listed waste in some cases. It can be identified as a characteristic waste. For example, benzene can be identified in a number of different listed wastes in the F and K and U and P U codes. I mean, numerous waste streams in the F and K that include benzene as a hazardous constituent. Benzene's also on the U code. But benzene is also identified as a toxic constituent in the characteristic of toxicity. So you would actually have a, you know, you have a TCLP level that's been established for that. When the agency was first dealing with establishing treatment standards, they had, sometimes they'd have like a different treatment standard for benzene based on whether it was FO, you know, 6 versus KO 32 versus D0 18. And this caused a lot of confusion. So what the agency went about trying to do is to consolidate the treatment standards for benzene so it would be similar whether benzene was identified as a, you know, in a listed hazardous waste or whether it was identified as a hazardous constituent based on it exhibiting the characteristic of toxicity. These concentrations, okay, consistent concentrations for benzene that are found in whatever listed or characteristic waste code, we refer to those as the universal treatment standards. And those are in 268.48. And so that makes it a little bit simpler, if you can believe that, to understanding, you know, what the treatment standard for a particular constituent is based, you know, whether or not that hazardous constituent is found in, you know, a K-listed waste or F-listed waste or a characteristic waste. So that's what the universal treatment standards are. And again, they're broken down by treatability groups. So you'll have universal treatment standards for benzene when it's, you know, in a hazardous waste that meets the treatability group of wastewater or non-wastewater. Now, where am I getting to with this? I'm going to this, another element of the definition of a treatment standard, but this is treatment standards for underlying hazardous constituents. This is a treatment standard that's unique only to RCRA characteristic waste. If you recall earlier, we said, you know, RCRA identifies four characteristics of hazardous waste: ignitability, reactivity, corrosivity, and toxicity. If you have a waste that exhibits the characteristic only, not only do you have to treat the waste for, you know, the characteristic that makes it hazardous, but you may also have to treat for any underlying hazardous constituent that's found in that waste stream that exceeds its universal treatment standard. So, for example, you have an ignitable waste. Let's just say you have some mineral spirit or paint thinner. That's not a listed hazardous waste under RCRA, but it would be considered hazardous because it exhibits a characteristic of ignitability. It has a flash point below 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Let's say this paint thinner was contaminated with some lead. The lead wasn't high enough to exhibit the characteristic of toxicity, so it wasn't more than 5 milligrams per liter under the TCLP test. But the lead was higher than what its universal treatment standard under the LDR program is. What happens now is that when you're trying to identify what the treatment standards are for that spent mineral spirit, ignitable mineral spirit, are, you'll see that you go down to the table in 40 CFR 268.40, and you'll see D001, non-wastewater, and we'll say DEACT, which is DEACT, that's the abbreviation, and then meet 268.48. What that's telling you basically is that you have to treat the waste and render it non-ignitable, but you also have to treat for any underlying hazardous constituents which are reasonably present that are above their universal treatment standards. So in this case, before that mineral spirit could go, or the residuals from that mineral spirit after treatment could go into a landfill, I would have to, you know, treat it in such a way, combust it, most likely. So I render it non-ignitable, and then I'd have to ensure that any lead concentration that remains in that treatment residual is below its universal treatment standard. So this concept of treatment for underlying hazardous constituents only applies to those hazardous wastes that are defined or that are identified as hazardous waste by virtue of exhibiting the characteristics. So that would be the ignitability, reactivity, corrosivity, and toxicity characteristics. Okay, hopefully I still have you all with me. And then we'll move to the last element of the definition of a treatment standard, and that's alternative treatment standards. EPA has gone about identifying certain categories of hazardous wastes where they avail themselves to what they call an alternative treatment standard. There are three of them that are commonly employed or used at a Superfund response action. And those would be an alternative treatment standard for lab packs. Those of you who aren't familiar with what a lab pack is simply if you're doing we see this a lot in the removal world where you're doing cleanups at old laboratories and you have small amounts of little chemicals have similar, properties. Some might be organometallic, some might all be just organics. Rather than trying to identify all these numerous different treatment standards for each hazardous constituent, which might be in all these small little chemicals, bottles or samples that you have to dispose of, you can just, EPA has established, broad treatment standards for two different types of lab packs, and you can avail yourself to using them instead of trying to identify individual treatment standards for each chemical, which is considered a hazardous waste, in those lab packs where you were taking the chemicals and putting them in another drum and then preparing them for disposal. Hazardous debris is another one. Hazardous debris is kind of like, sounds like what it would be, but the common example we see are things like secondary containment, concrete pads that have been contaminated from releases, and the contamination is considered to be hazardous waste. Say you had a storage tank, a TCE. I'm fond of using that as my chemical here today. But again, the TCE, the tank leaked, the first couple of inches of concrete pads were saturated with TCE. So it was considered, if you were to break that up and throw it away, it would be considered a hazardous waste. The agency has developed treatment standards for hazardous debris. So rather than having to incinerate that concrete, you could simply pressure wash it or apply another technique or method, which they identify in their alternative treatment standards for hazardous debris. And after employing that, your secondary containment, your concrete, would be considered clean and no longer hazardous, and you can simply dispose of it as construction debris. However, you would have to manage the residual. You would have to manage the residual, which would be like the rinsate, as hazardous waste that results from the pressure washing of it. Then the third and final alternative treatment standard, and one which is often used at Superfund sites, is the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil. This was established about 10 years ago. And again, this is where the case where you have soil that is considered hazardous waste because it either exhibits a characteristic or contains listed hazardous waste in it. Rather than meeting treatment standards for those hazardous constituents present in the soil that are based on treating an industrial waste with those hazardous constituents and not contaminated soil, the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil basically provide more flexibility. They're not as stringent. They only require, say, a 90% reduction of the maximum concentration present, in the soil, or they cap the treatment at 10 times the universal treatment standard. So they basically give you an order of magnitude greater in meeting the treatment standard if that constituent's found in contaminated soil versus if that constituent was found in a regular industrial-generated hazardous waste. So the important thing is just to remember that you do have these alternative treatment standards. They provide some flexibility and some less stringent treatment requirements for lab packs, hazardous debris, and hazardous contaminated soils if you have to address these in your Superfund responses.
Hey, Dave?
Yeah.
What slide?
Pardon?
What slide are you on?
Okay, I am on treatment standards. I just went to the next slide. It's called Determination of Treatment Standards. I don't have a slide. Oh, it's slide 30, I guess, on my thing.
Yes. Slide 30. Thanks.
Okay. So this slide here is just a recap of the process for determining the applicable treatment standard to a RCRA hazardous waste. First thing you need to do is determine what RCRA hazardous waste code applies. Is it F001, F002, D018, whatever? That's the first critical step. You find that code in 40 CFR Part 261, and you go through the process we talked about earlier and how you determine whether something's a hazardous waste. Once you determine it's a hazardous waste, then you need to determine what the applicable treatment standard, LDR treatment standard, is by consulting 40 CFR Part 268, specifically 268.40. And that's where you would take the waste code, say, and you would look and you would try to identify what treatability group and treatability subcategory, if it's applicable, or alternative treatment standard is applicable, applies to that waste. So we go back to the original example of spent TCE residual in a tank. It's F001. I look at F001 in 268.40, and I know that residual would probably be considered a non-wastewater because it's not going to be more than 99% water. It's obviously going to be TCE is going to be much more concentrated than that. So I would look for the non-wastewater treatment standard for TCE, and that would be my LDR treatment standard for that residual hazardous waste FOO2 that was in my tank that I had to get rid of. If I had a characteristic waste, those are the D waste. If it was characteristic only, I would determine the treatability group that my waste falls into. But the other thing I'd have to be concerned of is whether I have underlying hazardous constituents. The list of underlying hazardous constituents are all those hazardous constituents identified in the universal treatment standards. You don't have to assume your waste has any of those. It's, again, based on what you reasonably know about it or whatever sampling data you have. But if you did have a characteristic waste, let's say that the tank residue, it wasn't a listed waste. It was D001, but it had a little bit of lead in it. So that's a potential underlying hazardous constituent. I would look at the treatment standard for D001. I would see combust, which just means combustion technology. But I also see that it would say meet 268.48, which is basically means treat for the underlying hazardous constituents. If I knew lead was there, I'd have to determine if that lead was above the universal treatment standard for non-wastewater lead. If it were, not only would I have to deal with the combustion, but I'd also have to treat the lead and the residual from the combustion process to meet that universal treatment standard before, again, the waste could ultimately be land disposed. Okay. I talked about the next slide's alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil. I already discussed that. Again, the point there is it provides an option instead of meeting the individual LDR treatment standards for that are based on or established for existing industrial waste. You just have to meet a performance standard where the concentration of hazardous constituents are reduced by 90% and are capped at 10 times the universal treatment standard for each constituent. The next slide just has a few more points on regarding the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil. We'll skip that. The next slide is prohibitions against dilution and storage. I've talked about those already. Generally, those don't apply at Superfund sites. You don't run into them. EPA has taken a couple enforcement actions against industries where they violated the dilution prohibition in the past, but those are fairly rare. And then the final thing I just want to mention here are variances and petitions from the LDR treatment standards, because these have been used at Superfund responses before. They're not frequently employed, okay, but they have been used where you've had, again, a large volume of waste that, because of the LDR treatment standard, which was required, you know, was identified or as being applicable to the management of that waste, made it cost prohibitive to perform treatment. There is a process by where you can petition to obtain an alternative treatment standard, which might result in a less stringent standard or even a risk-based standard where if you met that treatment standard, it also would say the stuff is no longer hazardous waste at all. It has been used before in Superfund sites. Petroprocessors was one that I think was one of the earliest, one of the sites where that first used the treatability variance from the LDR treatment standards to obtain a less stringent standard, and that resulted in a lot of the waste streams, the petroleum-based sludges that were at the site, to be treated instead of simply capping the site and leaving an extensive, you know, a huge amount of waste on site. So that's just, I don't have enough time to go into the variances more, but just be aware that there are these various treatability variances that may be used. You also see something called a no migration petition down there. Don't concern yourself with that. That's basically where there's only been a few of those that have been granted by the agency over the past 20 years. And that's where you prove that the landfill or land disposal unit will never essentially allow any hazardous waste constituents to leak or leach or somehow escape the site for as long as they'll remain there. So it's a very difficult petition to obtain. Again, another way you can avoid the LDR treatment standards is if you delist the hazardous waste. Obviously, if you delist it, if it's a listed hazardous waste and you're able to successfully delist it, then the LDR treatment standards are no longer applicable. Okay, the next slide just discusses more about the treatability variance. I just mentioned that, so we'll skip that. The next slide has a few tips on treatability variances. Again, this has been delegated to the regional office. It's included if you do employ it in your record of decision or if you're OSC in your action memo, if it's a removal action. A concurrence memorandum is generally required by the RCRA program, but may not always depend on your region. And then we have some examples here. I kind of went through a couple of examples earlier to show you how the application of the treatment standards are. We only have about 10, 15 more minutes there, so I'm going to skip that. I will open it up real quick if any of you have some questions. Again, I'll try to answer them as best I can. Is there any burning questions on LDR treatment standards, guys?
Dave, I actually, this is Mike. I have a question I think that came in a little bit earlier on the application of the TCLIP and the pills. So the question is, and this comes from Josh Barber in EPA Philadelphia.
Sure.
If you have a landfill and you're relying on characteristics, most likely a TCLIP, to determine if you have hazardous waste, to what extent of the landfill would the samples apply? For example, would one sample apply to the entire 65-acre landfill, even though you know that the waste varies throughout the landfill? How would that work?
Yeah, that's basically a question on representative sampling there. If I had only one sample, a TCLP sample for, 15,000 cubic yards of, say, contaminated soil, I wouldn't necessarily consider that representative, if I'm understanding your question correctly. You might – typically what's done is there's a sampling approach that's established, whereas you excavate the soil, you make composite samples to get a more representative representative level of what the hazardous constituent concentration is in it via the TCLP, and then make a determination on each batch that you sample whether it exhibits the characteristic of toxicity or not. That's typically what I've seen done. I hope that kind of addresses your question. I don't know. Mike, did you get a response back?
Yeah, I'll let you know. Right now, that's the only one that I have here.
But, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think that comes into play, how many TCLP samples are used to characterize, media or waste at a site as hazardous. It's going to vary, depending on what you do, how you define what's considered a representative sample. Okay, we have about 10 minutes left here, and so I just want to talk about some quick common RCRA requirements for managing hazardous waste on-site and off-site. I'm going to be very brief on this because we don't have much time. But typically, now again, you have something you've defined as hazardous waste, and you need to manage it on-site. So RCRA is considered an applicable requirement to the management of that hazardous waste while you have it on at your Superfund site. The typical RCRA requirements, action-specific applicable requirements that are considered at most Superfund sites are container standards, because hazardous waste are often placed in containers. And containers are obviously drums, but they can also be roll-off boxes. Basically, a container under RCRA is anything that's made of non-earthen materials and is portable. A tank car, railroad tank car, can be considered a container. A baker tank, I've even heard those things being considered portable enough to be considered containers as well. Then some of the other things are temporary units, areas of contamination, CAMUs, and staging piles. We'll talk about those in just a few seconds. The off-site requirements are applicable requirements, and those are for any hazardous waste that will be being sent to a TSDF, Treatment, Storage, and Disposal Facility. Real briefly, the requirements that are going to apply are pre-transport standards. Those are basically requirements that cross-reference the Department of Transportation hazardous material regulations. So when you're preparing hazardous waste, because they're considered hazardous materials under DOT, how you label the containers, how you pack that stuff in a tanker truck, box truck, dump truck, whatever you're using, that's all going to be regulated by the Department of Transportation. So the packaging, labeling, means of transportation, methods of transportation over public, via public commerce or public roads, are all going to be governed by DOT. You also have to use the Hazardous Waste Manifest, which is a unique document established by RCRA, which will basically track the waste from its point of generation, which would be the Superfund site, via the transporter to the ultimate treatment, storage, and disposal facility. So you'll have to complete and use a manifest, a Hazardous Waste Manifest, as your shipping paper. You also need to obtain an EPA ID number, because you'll be functioning in a role as a generator, so you have to have an EPA ID number for the site. Your transporter and your TSDF will also have to have EPA ID numbers as well. The TSDF will also have to have a permit, and they'll have to, within the context of their permit, they'll have to have approval or the ability to receive the waste that you're sending off-site to them. As I mentioned before, to ensure compliance with the land disposal restrictions requirements, for at least your first off-site shipment of that waste to the treatment, storage, and disposal facility, in addition to providing a hazardous waste manifest, you also have to provide an LDR tracking form. The regulations discussing the type of notification requirements for purposes of LDR tracking are found at 40 CFR 268.7. Basically, usually your vendors will have some sort of standard form that you fill out, which identifies the applicable LDR treatment standards that apply to the waste, whether it can, you know, whether it meets the treatment standard, whether it requires treatment. But this information has to be attached to the manifest with the initial shipment to the subsequent handler. In addition, when you ship hazardous waste off-site, under RCRA, if you're a large quantity generator, so that means you generate more than 1,000 kilograms per calendar month, if you exceed that level, you're required to prepare a biennial report the following year, okay, or in some states an annual report. They require an annual reporting requirement discussing the amount of hazardous waste that's been shipped off-site, how it was managed. Some states use these reporting requirements as a mean of collecting fees. And so that's, again, the biennial reporting requirement is triggered by an off-site shipment of hazardous waste from a large quantity generator. Now, with a few minutes remaining, I'll just briefly talk about temporary units, areas of contamination, and corrected CAMUs and staging piles. The next slide just discusses containers. What it does is it references the RCRA standards for containers. They're pretty straightforward. Obviously, the containers have to be in good condition. You know, if they leak waste or spill, they have to be cleaned up. They're pretty self-explanatory on that. Let's go to the next slide, temporary unit. A temporary unit was a special type of remediation waste, hazardous remediation waste management unit was created by, under the RCRA Corrective Action Program. And basically, a temporary unit can be a tank or a container. But what it does is it avails yourself, especially in the case of like a tank, it allows you to operate or use a tank for hazardous waste management on site that isn't going to have to meet all the rather very stringent standards that are normally would apply to a hazardous waste tank system in the industrial world. So the temporary unit provides flexibility from, you know, the more stringent standards that would normally apply to a tank system employed for hazardous waste management by an industry. There are some limitations in terms of how long they can be operated, okay, and then you'll have to meet certain performance standards with respect to that tank. The next slide deals with this thing called area contamination concept, and this is simply where if you have a release or you have contaminated soil, you can identify an aerial footprint of that. And what it allows you to do is to manage that contaminated soil within that aerial footprint. You could consolidate it or move it around, okay, and EPA interprets, because they interpret that area of contamination kind of as a landfill, in effect, by consolidating and moving contaminated soil within there, you won't trigger, you know, placement and have to meet LDR treatment standards. This is assuming, again, that the contaminated soil is a hazardous waste. Nor would you have to meet what we call minimum technological requirements for a landfill, which would mean that you'd have to meet design standards for liners, leachate collection systems, and groundwater monitoring. AOCs are used often at Superfund sites. Again, it's just to facilitate some movement and consolidation of contaminated soils within the area of contamination for the purposes of performing the remediation. The other unit that's often used, not often used, but can be used at Superfund sites, is something called a corrective action management unit. This is a land-based unit. CAMUs are kind of similar to like hazardous waste landfills, but they don't have to meet exactly the same standards as a normal hazardous waste landfill, but they do have to meet like liners, caps, and address corrective action for any future releases. They're often used at sites where you have, again, a huge or large volume of contaminated soil, hazardous waste soil, or large volumes of hazardous waste like at former steel mills or mineral processing plants, where you want to basically create, you know, a repository and cap those as your means of protecting human health and the environment. CAMUs, if wastes are hazardous and they go into CAMUs, you still have to meet LDR treatment standards for the principal hazardous constituent. Okay. The agency distinguishes between CAMUs that are used solely for treatment or storage only versus disposal CAMUs. And then final things, the CAMU has to be specifically designated if they're going to be employed in a Superfund response, either in the action memo or the record of decision. Just a quick thing on the differences between AOCs and CAMUs, and we'll leave it, the discussion at that. CAMUs can be located in areas that are contaminated or non-contaminated. You can consolidate waste, remediation waste from throughout the site into a CAMU, whereas with areas of contamination, area contaminations are limited to the aerial extent of contamination that you define for the site. And so you can't move contaminated soil, say, from one area of contamination to another. That's disallowed by the policy. So you can only consolidate and move contaminated soils within the AOC. Staging pile, this last thing, I guess we have a few more seconds here and then we're done, is just another unit that was created that, again, avails you the ability to manage hazardous waste, usually media or other types of hazardous waste. On the land, there's some minimal requirements for a staging pile without having to specifically design the pile to meet LDR treatment standards or minimum tech requirements. The only limitation with staging piles is you're not allowed to actually perform treatment in them. You're only allowed to store stuff there, stage stuff in it. You can do some physical mixing, sizing, and blending, but you can't actually perform treatment, for example, like stabilization or some other type of biological treatment, which would be used to, reduce the volume or concentration or of hazardous constituents in the waste stream. Okay, I think that's about it. Thanks for paying attention. It's been a long 2 hours. I hope you guys got something out of it. I know it's I went rapidly through some pretty difficult and complex subjects, but summary, the big thing to understand is waste determination is critical to RCRA applicability at your sites. The process by defining a hazardous waste, know what it is, how it's produced, what you're doing with it, determine whether it meets the definition of solid waste. If does and it's not excluded from definition of hazardous waste, determine if it's listed. If not, see if it exhibits any characteristics. And that's how you go about determining what is hazardous waste. If a hazardous waste, you have to be aware of the application and the implications of the Land Disposal Restrictions Programs, particularly defining what the LDR treatment standards are for that particular hazardous waste. If you have hazardous waste on site and you want to manage them, you can avail yourself to things like temporary units, manage them in areas of contamination. These will provide some flexibility. If the waste is sent, hazardous waste is sent off-site, you have to comply with DOT standards for pre-transport and when you're sending the waste off-site, as well as filling out a hazardous waste manifest, LDR tracking forms, ensuring that the waste goes to a permitted treatment and storage disposal facility can accept the waste. And then if you send enough waste off-site, that qualifies a large quantity generator, you may also be subject to the biennial, well, you will be subject to the biennial reporting requirements as well. That's it. Again, thanks for paying attention. I hope you all got something out of it, okay? Is that it, Mike? Or did I go?
Yeah. I think we're okay. I'd like to remind everybody of the feedback form. If you want to provide feedback, if you go to the slide 51, it tells you how to do that. Also, there's also a link on slide 51 to additional resources. And if there are no questions, and Dave, I don't have any here on the feedback.
Okay.
So,
yeah. If you don't have any questions, I'm fine with that. If you do, I'll stick around and answer more.
I'm just waiting here to see if anybody chimes in on the phone. Okay, well, if there are no questions, I'd like to thank Dave for presenting the information to us today, and I'd like to thank the participants for logging in. So with that ends our presentation.